Welcome to Gonkcast, a long-form discussion podcast about the music of English electronic duo Autechre, album by album, EP by EP. I'm Gabe.
And I'm Dan.
And this episode, we're on to the first Autechre releases of the new millennium, including a strong contender for the most challenging album in the duo's discography, Confield, from 2001, and an EP that somehow goes even further down the digital rabbit hole, Gantt's Graph, from 2002. I guess I should say that technically the second Peel session was Autechre's first release of the 2000s, but it was actually recorded back in August of 1999, and anyway, we went in-depth on that in our most recent listener email episode. On that note, we haven't decided which minor release to package into our next listener email episode. I guess we're leaning We Are RY, but we'll see about that. But we'll definitely record an episode on all the emails we don't get to today, so you've still got time to tell us what you think about Confield and Gantt's Graph, gonkcastpod@gmail.com. Our next proper episode, 2 weeks from now, will be on Draft 730, so we want to hear what you think about that one too. gonkcastpod@gmail.com or tweet us at gonkcastpod. One more thing, if you like the show at all, do us a huge favor and leave us a 5-star rate and review wherever you get your podcast, and thanks so much to everyone who's already done that. All right, Dan, what background info do we need to know about Confield?
All right, yeah, so Autechre released Confield, their sixth LP, on April 30th, 2001. Sean said that most of the music on Confield, quote, came out of experiments with Mac's MSP that weren't really applicable in a club environment, and it remains in a somewhat controversial album for both its experimental nature and these generative techniques. However, the guys have spent a lot of time pushing back against this impression. In a 2008 interview, Rob claimed, there's a lot of mass and generated beats on Confield, but we never considered that album very difficult. It's like pop music compared to some of the stuff we considered putting out. And even when the beats sound like they're moving around in time and space, they're not random. They're based on sets of rules, and we have a good handle on them. Sean also clarifies that only three tracks on Confield had max sequencing. It just gets massively overblown because people think it's dead interesting, but it's not, is it? To me, it's just like a bunch of arpeggiators plugged into each other going off, and we've been doing that same thing since the Lego feet days.
Yeah, in regard to reception, legend has it that no one knew what to make of this crazy album at first, and that years went by before it achieved classic status. Listener Chris wrote us to say, straight up, no one liked Confield when it arrived, but as far as I understand, it's been voted the best album in the AE subreddit in the last year. I find this fascinating. In truth, it seems like Confield was mostly greeted with grudging respect to me. Pitchfork gave it an 8.8, The Wire's review is equal parts confusion and awe, and even AllMusic, who seems to hate this entire period of Autechre, concedes that Confield is, quote, a record to respect, not enjoy. Fast forward to today, though, and Chris is totally right. Confield is sitting at a 3.79 on Rate Your Music, making it one of Autechre's highest rated releases, and if you look at the rating trend there, you'll see that it just keeps going up and up. So what do you make of that, Dan? What is your sense of Confield's status here in 2020?
Yeah, you know, it sort of surprises me. I always thought, you know, in my own little bubble that this was sort of an album that people, you know, weren't that hot on. This whole, like, middle period that we're getting into, I felt like it sort of starts with Confield and continues for a bit. And it's sort of like the, you know, I don't want to say the bad period, you know, because I don't think any period is necessarily bad, but you know, it's the lower rated, the you know the more difficult, and you know, not the fan favorite kind of section. So it really does surprise me that it seems like that's turned around at least somewhat.
Yeah, I mean, I guess when I was first getting into Autechre, this was around the Choristus time. My impression was that Confield was like this dividing line. You know, it has a reputation for being very difficult. I think one of our listeners called it like Autechre's Mount Everest or something. And it did just seem like you were either going to climb it and then you were going to be with Autechre all the way, no matter where they went, or you were just going to be an early Autechre fan. You know, like it just drew a line in the sand there. I do think, though, that, you know, and obviously we'll get here, but by the time you get to like Oversteps and XI even more so for some reason, it was like a welcoming back into the fold of all of the, you know, departed Autechre fans. And I wonder if since then people have kind of returned to Confield in particular, but also just this whole period that you described, and have warmed up to it a lot. I mean, I feel like that's what, you know, they just didn't give it the fair chance. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think, I mean, even, you know, my personal history with the record, you know, I didn't listen to Autechre in 2001, you know, I was too young, I guess. Right. But, I, you know, like we've talked about, I, you know, I came into them through Trirepite and Amber and Incunabula, like the early stuff. And then I really always enjoyed the later stuff. And this middle section's always been sort of... you know, I've listened to these records, but they're never like the ones that I just throw on or have really spent none of them I've really like sat and like, you know, really spent a ton of time with just that singular record. You know, it's always, you know, I'll put it on and then I move to the next one or something. So even as somebody who came to Autechre later, I feel like I did that same, you know, sort of track. Like I was an early fan. I sort of skipped this middle and then came back in the fold. Basically the same, you know, Oversteps I loved and XI and stuff. And, you know, and now I'm coming back to it and, you know, I'll save my feelings for Confield and everything. But
yeah. I mean, I think I'm like in the same boat pretty much because I did sort of, you know, I listened to this whole middle period a lot, but never like as a single entity. It's just like if I felt like kind of exploring this little undiscovered realm or relatively undiscovered realm of Autechre, I would listen to it. But Confield, I got to say, as far as my personal history goes, it's an album that's just defeated me every time I've tried to listen to it. Like I always had a feeling that if I just forced myself to listen to it over and over again, I would probably come to love it. But, you know, when you're not doing an Autechre podcast, it's hard to have that kind of discipline, especially when there's so much great Autechre to move on to. So, yeah, you know, this I was like, if I'm going to get into this album, it's going to be, you know, this time. But, you know, I do find it kind of difficult. Maybe we can move in, though, to describing that overall sound.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult. I mean, it's definitely like digital. You know, there's a lot of like... I hate to use like the buzzwords, but there's a lot of like, you know, glitching happening here. A lot of sounds that sound like, remember when you used to have to dial up to the internet? A lot of sounds that sound like the modem noise. Just very not sounds made by like an instrument of human creation. You know what I mean? Not a guitar or actual drums. You know, I don't really want to use the like robot term. You know, we'll get into all this later. You know, but for lack of a better term, you know, robots.
Yeah, I mean, you're raising all of the like, you know, points that we're going to spend a lot of time on, but just that make this seem difficult, that make it seem robotic and cold and alienating, you know. But it's weird because when I try to describe this album, it's sort of conflicting because I think the things that do jump out at you are the difficulty. You know, there's something about the percussion here that is very irregular and bizarre. So that strikes you immediately. It also feels like there's a distinct lack of melody here. Like it's really just noise and strange digital shapes and things like just floating around your head. And yet, you know, if you spend enough time with this, I think that the beats start to make a certain amount of sense. You know, it's not like you find yourself wishing that, oh, I would love like Eidetic Kaysen. This is going to be a tough one to pronounce the names, but, you know, whatever track. I would like it a lot more if the beat would just stay normal the whole time. You know, it's not like you end up feeling like that. You end up feeling like it's very fitting. And to me, it just comes to make perfect sense. Same thing with the melodies. It's like, it initially sounds like a complete absence of melody on this whole record, and yet you start to identify them, and, you know, we'll get into it, but there's some tracks there that are very beautiful, that are very melodic, you know? So it's like, you know what I mean? It's like hard to describe because I feel like you get used to it. Did you have that experience?
Yeah, exactly. You know, because like I said, I, you know, this is always like you said, you know, I always just kind of get into this middle period by like, listening to the whole thing at once, never really like digging in. And so I feel like with this record and even, you know, the first time I listened to it, you know, in preparation for the podcast, it did feel like so, you know, difficult and kind of just like, you know, cold and it was almost like, you know, I've talked about before, I like Venetian snares and stuff, but it's like, You gotta be in sort of the mood for that, you know. Yeah, it's not just something you throw on, you know, driving around or something. And so it kind of was like those feelings, and I was kind of like, am I gonna get in the mood for it? Because we've talked about, like, on previous records, you know, like LP5 and stuff, there'll be like this, you know, the noisy things or like these weird sounds, but it was always sort of grounded by, like, you know, a nice little synth thing in the background or a pad or something that, like, very easily to anchor yourself to. Here on Confield, I feel like all those anchors, like, don't reveal themselves until it clicks for you. And so it definitely, like, takes, and I think a lot of Autechre records do, but I think this one maybe a little bit more takes, like, repeated listens. But yeah, I mean, to answer your question, it did sort of finally, you know, click for me.
Yeah, because, you know, if you think about, like, the first track, like, VI Scos Poise, I guess I could call it Six Scos Poise. I don't know why I prefer VI, but I just do. That was like a rocket ship or something. But, you know, it's misleading in a way, because all you can think about are these, like, weird ringing and rattling sounds. There's, like, a couple layers of them all around your head. And, you know, it's back to that thing that I was kind of missing on LP5, but that, like, you know, creating a physical object in digital space.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You have a sense of, like, these little things, like, what they are, how big they are, you know, and you can only focus on that. And what I think you just miss, like, the first five times you listen to this is this incredibly warm and inviting, like, gorgeous keyboard piece underneath, you know, it's just lovely. And it's got, like, this very, you know, I want to credit, there's this author, Joel Ebner, all right? So he's going to write a 33 and a third book on Confield. He only wrote, like, the intro chapter and ended up just posting that online. You know, and he makes this good point that it's, like, got, you know, the rubato, if I'm pronouncing that right, rubato of, like, classical music, you know, with that expressiveness where you slow down and you speed up and stuff like that. So it's got, like, a very human touch to the keyboards there, you know? And it's awe-inspiring. It's just that you at first cannot focus on it, because I was trying to make sense of, like, how do these sounds fit together? And it's almost like if you had somebody playing, like, a piano and you just amplified and destroyed the sound of, like, their chair creaking, you know, and, like, that was the lead sound on the piece. But you know what I mean? How it's like, you can find it. It's there.
No, I mean, I'm glad you brought that track up. That's a song I, like, really came to, like, absolutely love on this record. You know, the first time you listen to it, it's kind of felt like an intro, and it was just sort of like, all right, you know, we're getting through it, you know. But then I really came to, I mean, it might be my favorite song on here, actually. I really like, you know, it's and I think he talks about it in that 33 and a third little chapter, which I wish that got made, you know. I love those books. You know, I've would have definitely read that one. But, you know, he talks about it in there, like, how it's like these sound sculptures. And I think that's, you know, you mentioned, like, making these, like, sort of, like, physical objects in a digital space. And it's like the first time you hear it and stuff, you know, it just sounds like this, like, such a cold, like, you know, drone kind of thing. But then it really, like, reveals itself. It has, like, this such, like, a nice, like, weirdly beautiful you know, keyboard melody in there. And you know, and I think it was in that 33 chapter, it was one of the articles I read this week, you know, they said that, like, you know, it gets, like, this sort of robot, you know, you think of, like, inhuman and robot, but, like, that rubato, like, stolen time is what it means in, like, Italian,
right?
Like, that is, like, a human feeling, because you think of, like, a drum machine, you know, and with early you know, drum machine thing, especially, you know, people's chief complaint is that it, like, sounds too robotic, it doesn't sound human because it's too correct. And so, like, it you know, the time, like, drifting and you know, throughout this whole record, like, it kind of weirdly gives it, like, that human feel, you know. It's the least human record ever, but I mean, that is, like, such a human touch.
I mean, it's weird. I wanted to bring this up because to me, this is the most fascinating part of this album, like, period, is that it has a sort of organic quality to it. Because, you know, when I listen to, like, the rhythms that are going on in Scos Poise or, you know, Sea Fern, for example, most of the tracks, they have, like, an irregularity that I can only compare to nature, you know? It's like a weird, there's a weird shape to it. I mean, I think of, like, I was writing stuff down, like, this sounds like the rhythm of, you know, raindrops when they're, like, hitting your roof or something. You know, it's totally irregular. And so you know, you can barely find a rhythm there. Maybe you can if you listen close enough, but it's not robotic. You know, it's like organic. I kept thinking stuff about, like, when I'm listening to like Sea Fern, for example, it sounds like the aliens from the movie Alien look. You know how they are like organic matter, but they look like armor or something?
Uh-huh.
Like,
yeah, exactly.
Do you get what I mean? Like, it's so robotic, but so natural at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a, like, a strange, you know, dichotomy. There's an article in The Wire that you sent me about, like, generative music and stuff. And they in that, they say, like, you know, isn't... I'm just paraphrasing, but it isn't like a wind chime, a generative instrument.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And that, like, really sort of, like, that's how I feel about this record. And your rooftop analogy, you know, raindrops on the rooftop analogy, like, it's right, you know, like, nature can create these, like, you know, no one thinks of, like, the sound of rain dropping or the sound of wind chimes as, like, erratic or just, like, you know, senseless in its rhythm. Yeah. And I think this album is the same way, you know, like, it, on close inspection, you know, I think, like, it, you know, first listening or, you know, just light listening, it will seem just sort of like computer noises, you know, beeps and boops and erratic rhythm. But, you know, on close listen, it does have this, like, I mean, it feels so weird to say this natural feel, because the, like, the sounds themselves are, like, so digital and unnatural, but the, you know, the feelings and the rhythms and everything, like, are, you know, like, purely natural type rhythms.
But the interesting question that I think that 33 in the third chapter, again, I want to credit him, but I keep forgetting, Joel Ebner, what he brings up is that, you know, we are comfortable, like, he's talking about the Scoz Poise track in particular, but we're comfortable hearing a keyboard do that, like, move in expressive ways. Mm-hmm. We sort of associate it with, like, a human controller, you know, but we get weirded out when we hear, like, a programmed drums doing the same thing. And, you know, he doesn't use this term, but I started thinking of, like, Uncanny Valley, you know, where it's like, there's something disturbing about hearing that, which on one hand is so bizarre, because aren't drums just as a thing, like, one of the most, you know, primal instruments? You know, they're like the one thing that we associate with humans is, like, just beating on some object or something, you know? And yet it's like we've come all the way around where now drums sounding human sound, like, off and unhuman, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's strange, because you're right. I mean, I'm not an anthropologist, but I'm pretty sure that, you know, drums are, like, the very first instrument, you know, ever made. But I guess, maybe it's like we just sort of innately, or, you know, just from listening to pop music enough and stuff, like, when there's too many sounds going on or too fast, or like, maybe we know that a human, like, isn't actually possible, or, like, capable of playing that. And maybe it does kind of give you that Uncanny Valley sort of thing. And then maybe it's also, I mean, there's so much, like, you know, never on this record do the drums, like, just sound like a drum set, you know, they're always, like, very, you know, touched and like, glitched out and very digital and stuff, you know, right. So it might be a like, I mean, the sounds sound like what you would think of as a computer type sound, you know?
Yeah, and that's what's weird, is, like, because we know that it's not a human-made, you know, like, no human could play the percussion on Scoz Poise, for example. But we know that it's, like, moving, like, as if a human is doing it, and it's just very disorienting. This whole record has that quality. But it leads me to, you know, I've got a bunch of listener emails for this one, you know, which, to me, sort of confirms that it is a fan favorite here. But from listener Mike, we got this email. My initial reaction to this material is one of uneasiness and confusion. You know, I've seen others comparing this to, like, nausea, although sometimes it's said to have no feeling at all. So I wonder, when you listen to Confield, do you hear, like, a mood? Do you hear, you know, emotions anywhere?
You know, I don't know that I really do. You know, it does just feel like so... It's so hard to, like, explain, because it has this, like, natural feel, but I feel like the mood and the, like, sounds of the instruments are, like, so digital that it does, like, sort of strip any, like, humanness in the sound away, which kind of makes it, like, emotionless, or not emotionless, emotionless.
Yeah.
Like, it I don't know. Like, it makes me think of, like, you know, just space or something, you know? Like,
yeah.
You know, just atoms bumping around or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Or just, like, water flowing or, you know, there's no emotion in it, but it's, you know, there's something natural about it. It's yeah. so funny because this is going to be a tough episode because this is a hard album to talk about.
Yeah.
I love, I'll post it on our Twitter, but the Wires review from 2001, it's basically, like, this guy just being, like, I don't know how the fuck to talk about this.
Yeah.
And it's, like, kind of fantastic. My favorite line is when he says something like, you know, I hate the drums on Seafer and I wish they would shut up, you know, which is,
yeah, yeah.
which is so great because it is how I sort of feel about the drums here in that they are, first off, they weirdly sound too loud no matter what volume you play this at, you know, like they just sound too loud and they are so irregular and like off kilter that they are like they're unexpected every time. And I just keep flinching every time the drums hit or something. So, you know, if I start like digging around, I start to think of stuff like, all right, so the feeling that gives me, I guess you could call it an emotion, you know, it's like giving me some kind of dread. Like I'm like constantly afraid of the next drum hit there. You know, Pen Experts has this kind of, you know, quite a beautiful, like melodic, you know, noise burst of a chord, you know, that's getting like cut in and out. And it's got, I don't know, something like a pretty glorious, you know, feel to it. But I don't know. It's weird. I want to read another email from listener Jordan, you know, who's on this same topic. He says, people tend to think that Confield is nothing but glitch sounds and really cold compared to older stuff, but that's just untrue. Tracks like the opening track and UVL do a great job depicting tense restlessness. It's obvious that Pen Experts is more than just glitchy drums. And for Bine, listen to that and tell me it doesn't sound like a mental breakdown. You know, he adds parhelic triangle is like the buildup before the breakdown, which is followed by something more upbeat. The last track, Lentic Catacresis, is pure bliss. In fact, I would say one of the most beautiful tracks they ever made. It makes you feel like you're being bombarded and suffocated with positive things that make you want to open yourself and suck in all the love and energy like some sort of purification. Catacresis also sounds similar to catharsis, which it is, a cathartic experience. So what do you make of that? I mean, can you hear some of, you know, if it's like these moods like anxiety and dread and breakdown and stuff, do you hear any of that humanity in here?
I mean, you know, I don't disagree with who is it, Jordan, there, you know, I don't know that I felt those as much. I guess maybe in like Six Goy's Poise, you know, a little bit, I agree with him, but it's like I didn't really feel that, but I definitely like understand what he means, and I like don't disagree, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I just keep coming back to, like, for me personally, it's hard to say I hear a lot of human emotion, but I hear like something like natural forces or something that make me feel emotion. Like, do you get what I mean by that distinction? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm just observing something and it makes me feel a certain way about it, like some kind of dread about the sound or something, or like the size of the object that's hurling at me. But I don't know if it's in the thing itself. You know, I want to bring up like Bine. It's something like, I don't know, it sounds like a track has like imploded in on itself or something. And I started to think of like, this must be what a black hole sounds like. And, you know, it's like got these kind of organy, like ghostly organ tones, you know, going on. And they start to get so low and just, you know, like just low groans. And it started to remind me of, you know, that Baczynski album that came out last year, On Time, Out of Time.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
He collaborated with like some whatever laser interferometer gravitational wave observatory to record the sounds of black holes. And I wrote down, damn, this kind of sounds like that record. And then I looked it up and I was like, holy shit, that's what black holes actually sound like. And, you know, I just started to think like, okay, this track gives me this kind of dark and terrifying like nihilism, but it feels as, you know, emotionless as a black hole. Black hole doesn't give a shit about you, even though it's about to end your existence.
No, yeah, I mean, I completely agree with what you're saying. And in fact, like, you know, with COVID and everything, like, all I've been doing is reading because there's nothing else to do. And like, while I, you know, the 2 weeks that I've been listening to this record, I've been reading a bunch of like books about, you know, space and shit and black holes and string and all that crap. So I was like sort of like associating those like kind of things with this record, but I wasn't sure if it was just because of like the reading I was doing during it. So I'm kind of glad because, you know, You're hearing that night, you know.
Yeah, I think it's there. I really do. Here's, you know, another listener Rob, says certain tracks sound like a recording not by a living thing, but of a living thing, a giant intergalactic space demon constantly shifting shapes while it's on the hunt for planets to devour, but a living thing nonetheless. You know, we've kind of been getting at this and, you know, describing that kind of organic, you know, possibly even living feel to the tracks themselves. But, you know, it's interesting to think that I complained about LP5 a little bit because it felt like the sound design wasn't really there. It was more like compositional. And here it feels like maybe they've swung the other direction where it's, you know, sound design is first and foremost. But mm-hmm. I think they achieved something here where, you know, I used to listen to Autechre, you know, as we've been going through it, these previous albums, as like combinations of interesting sounds that they've created, you know? And this is the first time that I feel like these tracks are just singular, you know, things. I don't know how to describe this, but I just feel like Rob made me think about it, where it's like we'll get to like the Gantz Graph music video later, but I feel like that video is almost instructive on how to listen to this period of Autechre. Yeah. Because if you just shut your eyes, any of these tracks sounds like a singular shape, like some totally weird abstract shape, and one that's like moving around and morphing and shifting all over the place like a living thing. But it feels like totally synthesized, like totally singular rather than a combination of things. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think like what listener Rob like said in that little email, you know, I mean, what he's describing is basically what a black hole is, you know? I 100% see that. I mean, the artwork for this record kind of is that. And, you know, there's that little promo video that you sent.
Right.
You know, that
promo
is,
video that the album art comes from.
Yeah, sorry. I guess people don't see what you send me. You know, where the stuff's moving around and like, you know, I really do feel like that is, you know, it's creating these like real objects in digital space, you know, either auditorily or, you know, with the art.
Yeah. I'm just like impressed by how synthesized it is. I kept thinking of like, you know, that Salvador Dali painting of like a guy like emerging from the egg or whatever.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I kept thinking about that while I was listening to this because it just feels like, you know, like something like sea fern, right, is like just this weird shape and like something is trying to emerge out of it or something. Or like Penexpers has like, it's almost like at war with itself with this, like these gorgeous chords. And then these, like, there's something about the sound of the drums that sounds like it's like ripping through the track, like actually intruding on the track or something. And I don't know. You just think about like, you just shut your eyes and you imagine like the shape or whatever blob is like wiggling around and trying to rip out of itself and imploding on itself. You know, just imagine that while you're listening to Penexpers, and then imagine while you're listening to Seafern, and it's like just two totally different shapes, but they are totally whole shapes nonetheless. You know, I think this sort of leads us though to the endless fun, and being a little sarcastic, of speculating about Autechre's gear. I want to shout out listener Blue Shades, Eric, and AT for sending us some extremely thorough breakdowns of how Max MSP works and how Autechre might be using it. And while we've relied on their explanations in speculating about the creative process behind the last few albums, Confield is obviously the turning point in Autechre's relationship with Max MSP. So I wonder, based on what we've learned from reading their emails and from reading elsewhere, you know, how do you think Max played into this album? Like, how generative is it? Is it that use of generative algorithmic stuff that makes it feel alive and you know, living?
I mean, you know, in no way am I an expert or anything. You know, I feel like I've just barely, you know, grasped the emails I've read and stuff. But I mean, it feels generative and everything. You know, I was thinking of it like, you know, I have like, you know, little hardware drum machines and stuff that have like very simple, you know, randomness, you know, you could set like the randomness for a track and it, you know, it'll play in that, you know, at that percentage or whatever. And I was sort of thinking of it in like, you know, that much more simplistic way. And like when I, you know, I use that personally, like to, you know, take something and, make it, you know, more interesting or you know, generative essentially. So I was thinking of it that way. And I mean, that's like, this feels like somebody who is much, much, much better at that generative aspect. So I feel like it is.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's stuff that I can totally hear where it's like on You of Y'all, for example, that second, you know, beat sort of joins in. And I just got to say, first off, that it is like, I get like sexually aroused when that beat comes in. It's so every time, it is so good. It's got like a jazz drum solo quality to it or something. It's just so, so good. But, you know, it's clear that there is like this low, I don't know, digitized feedback squealing or something that comes in with that beat. And it's clear that the kick drum starts to affect that sound. Like it's changing the pitch or something, or the speed of that sound. And, you know, from reading these people's emails, it's like, that's the idea I get, is because you can control every facet, you can set up some like kind of conditional situation where it's like, okay, when every time the bass hits, it's going to trigger this other sound and make it like change in some way, but like maybe just 75% of the time, or, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
They've set up all the parameters. So it's like carefully controlled, but it does add like kind of a living, breathing quality to it. I forget which, you know, emailer said this, but people describe Max MSP compositions as like, you know, ecosystems or something, because things are playing off each other. I mean, I do feel like that's what gives a lot of these tracks these feelings, but I wonder what you make of, you know, Sean's backtracking on this. You know, he's saying like Max sequencing was only used on three of the tracks. And in the 2013 Ask Autech or Anything, he sort of clarifies, he says, Parhelic Triangle wasn't algorithmic at all. Sim Gishel was slightly. You of Y'all was a lot, but none of it's in the way you probably think of algorithmic, with loads of randomness. It was all planned out, with bits of it being executed after intervals, etc., like a track, but codified. That's the thing. When you say algorithmic, people think you mean unplanned and sprawling. Doesn't mean that at all in our case, just means procedural. So what do you think of that? I mean, what do you think of him like kind of acting like it wasn't such a big part of this?
I mean, I think maybe he's, you know, because I think he's right in like a lot of times when you say like generative or algorithmic, like people think that means like you just said it and you can leave the room and
it
the song makes itself. But I think I get what he means, is that like they have like, you know, they've probably labored over these parameters and stuff. And like you just said, you know, like you could say this affects this, you know, whatever percentage of the time and stuff. And like,
right.
I mean, that's you're leaving some like you know, chance or randomness up to the machine, but I mean that is compositional, you know, like you had to like
right.
You know, the computer doesn't just come up with that, and so I think like maybe that's like what he's trying to get away from, is like this seems like so much work went into it and everything. I can see not wanting people to think it's just like, oh, you know, we typed some shit into the computer and the computer makes it, you know. I can see like wanting to backtrack it because the layman doesn't understand. You know,
well, yeah, I mean, I sent you this, you know, article that was in the Wire. I'll share it on our Twitter as well, but you know, it's from a 2001 issue about generative music, and it's sort of saying like generative music is kind of making a comeback, and it's talking about like this long continuum of generative music, and they speak to Autechre briefly, Oval, a few others, Brian Eno, like about this whole history of generative music. And I found it very interesting because most generative music seems to be like calling attention to, you know, the generative quality of it. Like that's what the track is about. Process by which it's made.
So process, it's like, music. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like, you know, you want to say something like, oh, well, this, you know, this track is made by, I'm sure people have seen like this viral video of like somebody set up guitars all around this room and they're just birds flying around and they land on the strings and, you know, fly around and it just makes like this drone, like this interesting musical drone. And so I'm sure the piece is called like Birds Play Guitars, because that's like the thing they want you to care about it. So it's just interesting to think of Autechre entering the fray of generative music and then stressing at every opportunity that it's really not generative and we don't really want you to think of it as generative. You know what I mean?
Well, I think like the difference might be because, you know, something like Steve Reich, like, you know, Pendulum Music or, you know, It's Gonna Rain or something, like, you know, those process, like, if you just heard Pendulum Music, which I, for people who don't know, it's several microphones like swinging over an amp, and you know, when it crosses the amp, it feeds back. If you don't know that and you just listen to it,
It's nothing.
It'll sound stupid, you know? And I mean, you know, like, it's going to rain and come out and stuff. Like, it's just, you know, sort of, you know, speech played back over and over and phased so that it, you know, it drifts in and out of each other, of itself. And again, right. If you don't know that, it just is, it'll be kind of dumb. Like the process is like what's important about it and like what's interesting about it, you know? So like you kind of, to enjoy that, those type of things, I think you have to know about it. With Ottekker, and I think this is again, why I sort of understand like him backing away from it is, like, you can't call this, I mean, I guess they sort of almost do, but you can't call the song, like, you know, Max MSP patch, you know, where the right. kick drum, you know, does the, it's taking, like, that process to such an extreme that, like, maybe the process doesn't matter as much anymore. I think it's, and it being in the same continuum, I think that Ottekker is, like, the, you know, they're on the other end of that, you know, things like Steve Reich and John Cage and all, like, you know, that is sort of the beginning, the Alvin Lucier and everything, like, and all that stuff, you know, again, like the process is like what is interesting. But then I think, like, you move through time and you get to where the process is a part of it, like the process just like makes the music. Like,
yeah, I mean, I it's sense. Just like they want the music to sort of stand on its own, really. And it's mm-hmm. like they probably discovered things by playing with some of these generative techniques. And I think they captured like an interesting living, breathing quality in a lot of these tracks with those techniques. And they can only be achieved with those techniques because, you know, your mind hears it and you're like, something is not programmed here. Like something is like behaving on its own. And it gives you that incredible sensation that this record gives you. But you know, you think about like the other side of generative music, like plenty of bands have used like Brian Eno's Oblique Strategies carts, right?
Yeah.
And there, it's not interesting enough to be like, well, no matter what this sounds like, you're going to dig it because it was made using these random cards that gave me random directions, you know? It's like they are a generative means of uncovering something interesting. I just feel like that's how Ottekker is using Max MSP, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great analogy, you know, like the Oblique Strategies doesn't definitely give you the answer. It just gives you a way to find the answer.
Right.
Yeah, so I think that, and I mean, you know, in the continuum, I think, you know, you could put things like Alvin Lucier at the, you know, beginning, and then, you know, maybe Brian, you know, Oblique Strategy sort of things are, you know, in the middle. And then, you know, Ottekker is at the end of that, that continuum.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to how Confield relates to Ottekker's previous albums. You know, this is the first time I think we weren't like just jumping at these comparisons, which might mean that it's like a bigger shift. But I wonder what you think. I mean, is it like kind of a natural growth from LP5 from like all of their previous albums, or does it feel like a hard left turn or what?
I mean, I think it is pretty much a left turn, you know. I mean, like you just said, we always sort of like you know, our rule is that we don't really talk forward, but it's okay to talk you know, backwards. And generally, like, we do that a lot, you know, in the beginning. We've really not mentioned other records very much here. I mean, I think we all agreed that LP5 was sort of like, you know, an easy listening, you know, like a good sort of entry point for Ottekker. And I think, you know, it's safe to say that Confield is maybe not the same thing, you know. So I feel like it is sort of such a left turn. And I mean, I'm pretty sure it was that 33 and a third article, which post that on Twitter too, because we're talking about it 100 times. You know, he talks about it like in the earlier records, you know, they, while like Ottekker does like some wild stuff and everything, like they're still always using quarter notes, 16th notes, 30, you know, whatever. Like they're sort of like always still like following, you know, basic rhythm. Whereas like here, they've like finally like gotten so granular with it that that's kind of out the window.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I did sort of mention it earlier in that if LP5 was less about sound design and more about composition and like music, then this is like a hard swing to the opposite direction as far as it is much more about the sound design than the music. You have to go digging, I think, for the music. And sometimes we'll get into it, but there's not, you know, there's not a lot to be found. But you know, my theory, and I can't back this up and it'll piss some people off, but it's just that, like, I mentioned it on the LP5 episode, but it's just like they might have resisted going digital as long as they did because it wasn't as inspiring to them. And when they did it, they thought, well, we can't make the sounds like as interesting because everybody's using the same gear and stuff. So let's just focus on the composition aspect. And it's like Confield is something like the breakthrough where it was like, well, maybe with Max MSP or whatever, you know, we can make digital sound design, you know, just as, you know, revelatory as the stuff we were doing with hardware before by like, you know, they're really like making hardware do stuff it wasn't meant to do and like really creating tracks out of that. And I feel like they figured out how to do that digitally. And that's why I feel like it's such a, you know, it's like a left turn, but it's more of just like a course correction or something, like what they were always interested in doing. And in some ways, going from LP5 to Confield kind of explains, you know, why I'm personally a little dissatisfied with LP5. And I know I'm kind of like skipping over EP7. I do feel like maybe that was more of an indication of, yeah, of what they might get with Confield. But I want to read from listener Chris. You were kind of alluding to this. He says, something I haven't heard much about thus far is tempo. Throughout the early releases, tempos are typically immediately present due to the more traditional nature of the rhythm structures. So many of the tunes are somewhat defined by the rhythm and also seem to reveal more direct influences. But once Confield arrives, tempo becomes something akin to strategically ambiguous. He also says, I find that I listen to everything pre-LP5, EP7 in terms of clear loops, but things become much more, what the fuck is going on with the narrative of this tune with LP5, EP7. And by the time Confield arrives, structure gets much weirder. On the other hand, listener Mike says, I feel like the beats make sense to the tracks they're contained in and work there and are hip-hop-ish in style, like if you abstracted its rhythm and danceability. So, you know, what do you think? Is it like they've totally abandoned, you know, loops and tempo, like these core, you know, pieces of electronic music making? Or do you hear the roots of, you know, these traditional forms that they've grown up on?
I mean, I think maybe, and this might be a cop out, but I think it's a little bit of, you know, column A and B, you know, I think they, obviously, I don't think there's like very clear loops here, but I think that's part of embracing like the digital style with the computer and everything. You can like, you can loop things that are like much larger, you know, a drum machine might give you, you know, six, you know, three bars or two bars or one bar, you know, to loop, where, you know, once you get on Max MSP, I mean, I assume it's basically limitless, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, the group themselves, you know, sort of like said that this was, you know, kind of like a pop music, like, I forget the exact quote, you know, but we said it to be earlier in the episode, you know, so I think like, I don't think there's ever really a point in Odd Tekker that there's like not some sort of, you know, hip hop niche to it. You know, I mean, we've talked about it, you know, they've said like they're, you know, B-boys at heart and everything. And I think like they never fully abandon that. It's always, I mean, it gets definitely like harder to find, but I mean, some of the beats here, I mean, Steve Fern, I feel like, I mean, while it's like really sort of like a janky, like, you know, yeah, time shifting, kind of beat. I mean, at its core, I mean, it's like pretty like funky, you know. I think if you like sort of quantitized it and put it, you know, back where it, you know, quote unquote, like should be, it would just be like a funk beat.
Yeah, I mean, I would say like on Eidetic Kaysen, this is clearly the hardest track to say here, I think, but that one's got like a real hip hop groove to it. Like it really grooves to me, and like the, you know, melodic elements are actually, they're kind of skipping and accelerating in like a drain two kind of a way. But not just skipping, but also skipping in the sense of like, you know, somebody like a child skipping, you know, like,
yeah,
it has kind of like a fun, fluttery, like, you know, bounce to it, that whole track. And, you know, I do hear some of that. I gotta say, like, I hear like a pretty clear loop on Sim Gishel. I think like that's a pretty loop driven track after three like very twisted and bizarre, like irregular beat pattern type things. Uvial also has a certain looping quality to it, but there's, you know, they make up for it with other things that are going on with like the different textured sounds and stuff. At the same time, I wanted to mention, like, this is the first time where I really feel like I hear some of those avant-garde influences coming through. We were talking about this on a recent listener email episode, you know, but like the melodic parts of Seafern, they just really remind me of like those kind of atonal, like Straussian Schoenberg kind of, you know, compositions or something. You know, I hear stuff on like Parhelic Triangle that makes me think of like the bells, you know, that are being played. They sound like very like real acoustic bells. And it does make me think of like a Steve Reich piece or something, like mm-hmm. where the, you know, it'd be like everybody play these two notes, but then if somebody changes, everybody changes quick as you can, you know, like one of those like kind of generative process music type of things, you know, ringing around in the background. I also hear some like kind of air sounds on that track that almost sounds like the kind of like extended technique of horn players and free jazz, you know, where it's just like, you know, like,
The overblowing or whatever.
Yeah, I feel like I can hear some like very clear avant-garde influence here, like much more than I ever did on previous releases.
I agree. And I sort of like feel like with the generativeness or you know, lack thereof, you know, whatever, you know, like the setting the parameters, but you know, as composition and not like, you know, sitting there and saying, you know, we're playing these notes, you know, blah, blah, blah. Like that is a very, you know, like free jazz sort of thing. I mean, it really just a jazz thing in general, you know, you play this skeleton, you know, like, It's not that a song, you know, it's not that a free jazz song is like just everybody jumps on stage and does whatever the fuck they want, you know. That's what people who don't understand it think it is. It's playing with it, you know, you set yourself like, I don't really want to use the word rules, but I mean, that's sort of it, you know. I guess better term would be parameters, you know, you just analog parameters, and then you play within those parameters or around those parameters, and then I mean you can even you know, break them a little bit and stuff, and I think like that is like, this is just the, you know, 2000s version of that, you know.
Yeah, you know, there's a quote from that same, I think, 2008 like Sound on Sound interview. I can't remember which one says it because I didn't write it down, but either Rob or Sean, it's safe to say, says, it seems that for a lot of people, if they hear something that doesn't sound regular, they assume it's random. Mm. If live musicians were playing it, they'd probably call it jazz or something. But the fact that it's coming out of a computer as they perceive it somehow seems to make it different. For me, it's just messing around with a lot of analog sequencers and drum machines. It's like saying, I want this to go from this beat to that beat over this amount of time with this curve, which is shaped according to this equation. So I do feel like they're right on the same tip, but I do feel like they're really digging into like their avant-garde interests here, like just more overtly, I think. And it raises the question, which like all music kind of accuses this album of. I mean, is this like more of an academic kind of album than, you know, like a bangin', you know, people like love to dance to Try Repete and stuff, as weird as it is. Like, is this the first like serious jump into like, these are academic composers?
I think it's sort of safe to say that, you know. You know, we always sort of joke about how my wife and your girlfriend hate Autechre. And I think I'd have a much easier time, you know, putting on Try Repete or something. I didn't try it in the car with Confield because, you know, I know better. But, you know, like, I think this is definitely, you know, an academic listening thing. You know, this isn't car music or just, you know, hanging out, you know, kind of thing. This is like, you know, we even talked about it, you know, this isn't something like I feel like you'll just enjoy the first time you listen to it. It takes the deep listening
work.
And I mean, that's what, you know, and I love all these like, you know, composers and stuff that we keep talking about, like, you know, John Cage and stuff, like most of that stuff, like you don't just put it on and enjoy it. I mean, maybe some Steve Reich or whatever, but you know, the more like process kind of things, like you're not going to just enjoy that. It's like, you have to, you know, read about the process. You gotta like, you know, think about it and stuff. And I mean, I really enjoy that. I love like, you know, finding out things like that and it's the same thing I like about Autechre, you know, it's just sound design. You know, it's like a way to be an audio geek and listen to music at the same time, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's just funny that we were just talking about like how they're clearly heavily inspired by some of these like electroacoustic greats, you know, and here is where I think they kind of step into that arena and hold their own in that arena for sure. You know, and I do feel like some people will be outraged because they'll be like, you know, some people are like, well, what do you talk about? You know, you're ruining it. Like, you're supposed to feel it. You know, you're not supposed to like over intellectualize it and stuff. And you know, it's just, I guess in my opinion, it's like Autechre is kind of consciously like entering that realm of like, this is music to be thought about.
And I think that's a
dabbled with,
but I think that's a fair, you know, complaint. You know, if you aren't, if you don't care about audio and process and stuff, I can see like why you wouldn't care, and you don't, you just want to feel music. You don't want to learn.
Right.
You know, I mean, I don't want people to think like, you know, just because, you know, like if you don't like this record or you, you know, agree with that, like, you know, it doesn't mean you're
there
wrong,
are other Autechre albums you can listen
to. Yeah, exactly.
Plenty of other, but I just feel like we're going to get an email that's like, what are you talking about? Pen Expert slaps. Like, it's so much fun. Like, I dance to it in my living room.
Yeah, I'm sure somebody does. Yeah.
Somebody does. All right. I want to move on to what are your favorite tracks here, but first I got to quiz you. What do you think is the highest rated track on Rate Your Music? If Rate Your Music is anything like Consensus.
I mean, it's so damn hard on this record, you know? Are there any bolded? How many are bolded?
All but two are bolded.
All but two?
Yeah.
Jesus Christ. So I guess I'll just try to pick the highest one then.
Yeah, just the highest one, yeah.
I'm just literally guessing. I'll say Pit Experts.
You're right.
4. Oh, really? 4, 100% guess.
Yeah, it's apparently a big fan favorite. But what is, we got an email about it that I'll read in a second, but what are your favorite tracks here?
You know, I said it. I think Skoy's Poise is maybe my favorite, which was strange because it really, like the first, you know, few listens, it felt just sort of like inconsequential and like an intro and stuff. But I really came to like, really love it. I mean, even today I was listening to it in the car. I live just,
yeah,
I live about as long as it takes to listen to that song from work, and I just was like really enjoying it, like in a car, and I felt like, man, you know, I've gone too far. But so I really think that is probably my favorite song here. But I mean, it's a cop out, but I really love everything. I guess I also like Pen Experts quite a bit, and I mean I like Bind. I don't know, it's hard to say. The drum complaint on the Wire with Seafern. I kind of like the drums on Seafern, you know.
Yeah, even, I love it. I mean, I feel like he's being a little
facetious.
Like,
yeah,
like, that's
course.
The feeling it gives you, and I think he's admiring how they've achieved this, which is how I feel. I think, you know, Seafern would be one of my highlights here. I think it's like it's the second track that I think is, this album kind of graciously leads you in. Maybe like the first couple listens, all you can focus on is like the rattle on Skoy's Poise and like the slamming, like flinch-inducing beats on Seafern, but there's a lot of melody on these tracks, and there's melody on Pen Experts that like slowly emerges. But, you know, Seafern is a particular highlight for me. I love that like kind of groan, like that bass groan underneath.
Yeah.
You know, and I mentioned how it's just like the irregularity of the beat. It's just so impressive how they achieve that and how it just feels like the beat is like sort of morphing and shifting in an organic way. And, you know, I already spoiled it, but Uvial, like I said, that sexual arousal this track gives me, I don't get it anywhere else. It is like, when that second beat hits, I cannot say it enough. It's just the greatest thing on this whole album for me. And I just love the whole, everything about this track, like how it's like, it's got the sound of like, again, getting back at that, like kind of electroacoustic mixture. It sounds like, you know, when you like, lick your finger and like run it on crystal glass and it's like,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, that's like running in the background. And then
it does sort of sound like that.
You've also kind of got these like feedback rings and stuff like kind of mixing into what sounds like something like an acoustic, like real world sound. And I don't know, the whole thing just has this kind of like, I'm suspended in space and time or something. Meanwhile, there's like this crazy jazz drum solo going on. Like, it's just, I don't know, love everything about the track. I've read that they one time played, like broadcast on some radio thing or some stream, an 18-minute version of this, and I have to find it.
Oh, yeah. Because if anybody's got that, gunkcastpod at gmail.com.
Yeah, goddamn. Let me read an email from listener Mike. He says, my favorite track is Pen Experts, which I feel is a masterpiece in percussion. It's also symbolic of the album as a whole. When I first listened to Pen Experts, I was really trying to find anything to hold onto. It's so jittering and aggressive that I was just trying to follow the beat and most times got lost in it and thought nothing was ever there. But after repeated listens, you start to hear that hidden synth coming out and it's sort of soothing how it's under everything. And then the beat makes sense all of a sudden and now the whole track makes a lot more sense. This is basically how the album goes. You know, we've talked about Pen Experts just a little bit, but I mean, do you agree in terms of that track, and do you agree in terms of the whole album?
Yeah, definitely. I think that he put it like very succinctly. You know, like that is how this record goes. Like you and that song's a great example. You know, you listen to it and you're like, this is just crazy, you know, not even rhythm, you know, just random beats or whatever. And then, you know, that hidden noise in Skoy's Poise comes out, and the hidden noise in, you know, Penexpers comes out. And then once you hear that, you know, remember those pictures? I think they're called like Magic Eye, where you like, it's just like static and you stare at it and then like, you know, something pop, you know, a sailboat or something pops out. It's almost like magic ear, you know, once you like find the thing to focus on, it's sort of like, you know, morphs and now you say, you know, you understand it or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, Penexpers is interesting because I think it is like, it's one of the rare times where it feels like, instead of the kind of singular shape I was describing, maybe more like two dueling shapes. Like one has very sharp edges and one is like this very lush kind of like synth thing. And it's such a weird track because there's so much like compression on the kick drum that it's like drowning everything out in the track, but it's not a big booming kick. It's like kind of a dull thud of a like tiny kick. And it makes like the weirdest sensation in my head, like how it's like just erasing what sounds like an enormous wall of noise. You know, I kept thinking of like My Bloody Valentine for some reason when I was listening to like the synths underneath it, but it's just like the weirdest sensation. And it's funny because it does kind of like start out like chaos, and then you start to hear this like music fighting its way through, and the track starts to make a lot of sense. And yet I feel like Penexpers kind of, it just kind of leads you into the very opposite, in the sense of it brings you into like Sim Gishel, Parhelic Triangle, and Bine, which are essentially musicless. You know, like they kind of descend more and more. Like Sim Gishel is just percussion.
Yeah.
With like not really any music and just like different metallic buzzing noises and stuff. It's almost like minimal techno or something. You know, Parhelic Triangle is like this weird, I don't know how to describe it, bulbous, fast and bulbous, weird like looping thing with these like ringing bells that, you know, you almost feel like there's a melody there. And in fact, as the end of the track goes, you start to hear like the faintest hints of like a genuine lovely melody. And like right as it ends, you hear that melody alone for a second and you're like, oh, was that going on, that whole noisy mess?
Yeah.
Like,
and there's that noise that sounds like somebody like rubbing a microphone or something.
Yeah. And then you get to Bine, which like I said, just sounds like an imploding star. What do you make of that in terms of Mike's email here? Like, is there anything to grab onto in that middle stretch of the album?
I mean, there's definitely less to grab onto, but I think just, you know, maybe in context of the entire record, like, you know, once you've grasped like the record, you can anchor yourself to other things and make it past that little section. But I mean, like you mentioned in Parhelic Triangle, you know, I mean, there is like as light as it is, there is that like little melody to grab onto. I think those bells you can kind of grab onto, you know, a little bit. I think there's always like something. I mean, Sim Gishel's is a little difficult, but I mean, I think like,
I mean, at least the beat is kind of straight.
Yeah, so exactly. Like and that's,
can follow it.
I feel like there's always like, however tiny, there's always like at least something tiny to grasp onto, you know?
Yeah. I just feel like there's almost like a, you could call it generous or you could call it very deceitful, but the first three tracks kind of like lead you in my opinion. Like they really, like they're very melodic after you get over like the initial thing that's distracting you, and they kind of guide you in and then just deposit you in this absolute wasteland of noise. And then you emerge out the other side with Eidetic Kaysen, like I said, is just like a tangled mess of melodies. It's like actually too much melody all of a sudden. Uvial is beautiful, and Lentic Catacresis, which we haven't talked about just yet, but we will, is quite beautiful, at least in the beginning. And you know what I mean? It kind of like holds your hand and then like leads you into the very difficult part and then kind of like carries you on out.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I meant by, you know, the rest of the album kind of like, you know, anchors you through it. Because, yeah, I think I mean, we always talk about it, but like the sequencing of this album, I think is, you know, really good in that it does that, you know, I think that's, these aren't just like, you know, randomly, you know, algorithmically track list, you know, songs, you know, I feel like there's definitely a sequence and a purpose in that sequence here.
Yeah, well, I wanted to read an email from listener Ryan, who's kind of talking about some of these tracks. He says, Parhelic Triangle is like a digital waste dump with computer bugs flying around it. You are climbing and struggling not to sink into the deletion zone whilst the waste unit stirs and gargles the sea of waste data you're stuck in. I think this track stands out somewhat as the ringing sounds are very dirty and industrial, in contrast to the digital world that this album is often labeled as. Absolutely the most compelling and downright fucked up Autechre track of all time for me. Sim Gishel is like a digital parasite, like a sprawling mess of glitch across a screen. At points, it's almost possible to recognize some sort of string or chord melody, like the parasite's host is having their memory overwritten with a twisted version of something recognizable, all in a rather groovy manner. So, you know, we've talked about these tracks in particular, but do you find that, you know, we always get emails like this, and I love reading them, even though I don't think my brain works exactly the same way, but, you know, people like kind of ascribing a narrative to, you know, to albums and songs and stuff. And, you know, we were just talking about how the sequencing almost kind of forces you to do that. But do you think that Confield is particularly well suited to like thinking in narrative terms like that, or like painting a visual picture here?
Yeah, I think it really is, because like you're needing something to grasp onto. And I don't mean that in like a negative, you know, it's not like you have to feed yourself to make yourself like it. I feel like, Cause I know I don't really think the way, you know, I like getting these emails too. It's like interesting to see how people think about things. You know, I'm much more of like a, you know, very straightforward, you know, kind of thinking. But I mean, even like we sort of, mentioned, I sort of was doing it with this one, you know, with the stuff I was reading with like the universe and crap. And I mean, even, you know, what Ryan said, I think like the Parhelic Triangle thing, like, I mean, again, that sort of is like what a black hole is, you know, deletion zone being, you know, the event horizon and stuff, you know? So I think we're all sort of like, we're all sort of thinking of it in the same way. We're just ascribing different, you know, narrative qualities to it, but it's always sort of like this all consuming, you know, monster in some sort of way, you know?
And like absolutely impressive that it does give you a pretty clear, you know, we're all kind of on the same page. Mm-hmm, like you said, like, I mean, this is not just like random chaotic computer sounds and you can think of whatever the hell you want. Like it does have a certain something, some narrative, some kind of visual picture it paints is like very intended and very successful, I think. Let's move on to the weak points here, if there are any for you. But let me quiz you again. Like I said, there are only two unbolded tracks here on Rate Your Music. So what do you think they are?
I mean, maybe Sim Gishel being one.
Yeah, that is one. Yeah.
Okay, and then maybe Bine.
I would have guessed that too, but it is Eidetic Kaysen. This is like I hate saying this, the name of this one.
Yeah,
but,
I know.
That is weird to me. I really would have guessed like Bine or even Parhelic Triangle.
Yeah,
Eidetic Kaysen. Somebody even wrote in and said like it's kind of like a banger after what you've just been through with the previous three tracks. I mean, I totally agree with that. But what are your, I mean, do you have any weak points?
You know, I hate to say it because it seems like a cop out, but I really don't. I like really liked this record. I think it's, I mean, all their records like work really well as an album, but I think this one like really kind of in particularly so, you know, like I never really want to listen to just like one song. It's like I want to experience the entire thing. I mean, because even that you know, middle section that's a little more you know, tough than the rest of it, I still like enjoy it, you know, like getting, and this sounds negative and I don't mean it that way, but I like getting through it is like the reward, you know. You know, like that sounds really bad, but like I look at that as like a pretty positive aspect here, you know. I really, you know, in one way it surprises me that almost the whole record is bolded here on Rate Your Music, but then in the other way, like, it really kind of doesn't, because I feel like
it's hard to pick.
Like if you like this album, you're gonna like the album, like you're not gonna, I can't see someone being like, Confield sucks, but I fucking love Perilic Triangle
I hate it, but I just love Bind, totally
putting
weird.
Seafern on my, my playlist. I feel like you're either in here or you're not in here.
Yeah. Well, let me hit you with this. Listener Mike, again, he writes, my least favorite track is Lentic Catacresis. This is one we haven't talked about much yet. I love the atmosphere of the track, but I feel they missed out by not making it more aggressive and epic to close this album out. The album closes on this really noisy, glitchy piece, and it's just too low key for me. It's too quiet and all over the place. I will say that, Mike kind of mentioned that he discovered Confield at the same time that he discovered Gantz Graf, and I wonder if Gantz Graf made him just kind of wish for like a more insanity, that he otherwise wouldn't have been missing. But what do you think of that last track? Because it is a doozy. It is like the last, it's 8 minutes long, and it's like the last 6 minutes are just chaos.
Yeah, I kind of agree with Mike, and I guess if I do have to sort of pick a low point, I don't think it is the greatest like closer. I almost like want more. I don't mean like more music. I mean like more of a closer. It's not like bad. It almost makes me feel like greedy or something. To say that, but I don't feel like it is like as worthy of a closer as maybe on some of the other records or something.
Yeah. I mean, I just feel like I kind of love it, but it is bizarre. And I kind of understand in the sense that it doesn't really like climax. It just kind of like, it enters like a stuttering territory and then just like plays out like that.
Yeah.
But I think it's kind of a remarkable track because it starts off like very pretty and very emotionally available to me. It almost, returns to the, I think, very gripping, accessible quality of Sko's Poise. And it's just like very lovely. I'm just loving it. And then it like slows down and you're like, okay, what's going on here? And then it just hits warp speed like all of a sudden. And what's crazy is that, you can hear those kind of like pretty chords kind of like looping deep underneath, like just this like rattle of skipping sounds. And I think they disappear and my brain just still hears them. You know what I mean? Like I don't even know for sure.
Yeah.
But there's something like, I don't know, nice about it. Like how it's just like, it's got like kind of a woozy, dreamy, like, I just kind of like how it goes on so long and I get lost in it. And I got to say, like, I'm like cracked up for some reason by the hi-hat that just keeps playing it straight through that. Like,
it didn't get the message.
Thank you. Yeah. Like, because everything else, and it's interesting because it almost is the first time in the album where it does sort of call attention to the process of this music, like the generative quality, because this is not a sound that you could get by a CD skipping or something, because everything is like skipping and fluttering at its own rate or something.
Yeah.
It's like you can hear all the different, you can hear all the different components that they've all gone mad like in different ways, and then there's that fucking hi-hat just like, you're like, thank you hi-hat, something to hold on to. But I do love how you can just feel like the wooziness. But the question of like, does it end this album on too low-key a note? I honestly want to say that this is kind of a low-key album, and it would be inappropriate for it to go into like Gantz Graf territory right at the end here. Do you think so?
Yeah. I mean, I know I complained that I don't think this is like the big closer, but I think it is just sort of like because that's kind of what they've been doing. But I think you're right. Like this is a low key record, and it's okay to have a low key ending. So it's just like if I have to do like a nitpick, but I don't necessarily like dislike it or hate it. And I mean, honestly, like if we did get something, if it went into a Gantz Graf like type thing, I might be complaining about that,
Yeah. Well, we've talked about the overall flow here quite a bit, but I do want to shout out listener Rob again, who says, I hear the album as three triptychs. The journeys that the first three tracks, the middle three tracks, and the final three tracks take me on feel similar to me. I think this is very insightful and very spot on. When he sent that email, it was so funny because I was like having the same thought, but I was thinking I must not have listened to it enough because I'm not, it's not like flowing perfectly. But we talked about it like a journey, through this like, kind of a welcoming you into this chaos and then leading you out of it. But do you think it's more like like three EPs or something, like three sets of pieces?
I wouldn't say three EPs, but three sets of pieces, you know, like three acts, you know. I mean, like you said, you know, triptychs. I definitely get that, because I mean, we said it, you know, like I think the most obvious of the triptychs is Sam Gishel, Pahirik, Triangle, and Bind, you know, like those are the like so difficult ones. So I definitely feel that, and yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Well, I also want to shout out listener Joe, who says, for me, the album flows incredibly well and has a very cinematic quality to the whole thing. So I feel like that's what we were talking about, where it kind of like builds and resolves.
Yeah.
It might be that we wouldn't think of it as a triptych if it wasn't that these three tracks come in the middle, because I feel like the first three tracks do complement, you know, they kind of fit with the last three tracks quite well. It's just like that you get led into the wilderness for a bit there. Which does give it that kind of narrative quality we were talking about earlier. We talked a little bit about the cover art, the overall aesthetic here, how the cover is a clip from a computer-generated promo clip that Autechre made. You know, if you've never heard of this, don't get too excited. It's like just 10 seconds long or something of just like computer images in silence, just flipping around. You know, it's interesting, like we talked about, because it does kind of give you that... you know, we'll talk about it more with the Gantz graph video, but it kind of like instructs you how to listen to this, like maybe to shut your eyes and think about some weird computer generated shape that, you know, sounds like nature, but couldn't exist in nature or something, you know, no machine, you know, no human could build this thing, but nature couldn't make it either, something like that. But I did want to ask you about listener Ryan. I never thought about this before. He said, is the white part of the album art supposed to be a C for Confield?
I've never thought of that either. I mean, I guess it's possible.
What are they trying to tell us?
Yeah, I don't know. This is another one that did Designers Republic do this one, or is this not?
I don't think so.
I don't think they did. Yeah, I don't know. It may be. I like it.
Yeah, I mean, the promo video also has that kind of C around it, let's say. So, don't know what to make of that, but I think you're right, Ryan. All right, before we sum up, we're running a little long as always, but you know, I always try to at least touch on the wider context. We are now in a post-Kid A Amnesiac world. So I'm wondering if you think, like, is electronic music and Warp's influence in particular kind of reaching a saturation point here? You know what I mean? Like, Boards of Canada are pretty massive at this point. I was even thinking of stuff like the Gorillaz have emerged at this point. Yeah. Daft Punk are, like, absolutely huge pop stars. You know, we're just leaving the point where, like, Autechre is going to be an influence on the mainstream. And it's fitting almost that this record is like just a complete departure from anything that like a pop, you know, a rock band would even try to pick up on anymore. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I don't know if that's, you know, on purpose on their part or anything, but I think you're right, you know, and I'm glad that they do that, because you're right. I think like this is like sort of like when it becomes electronic music becomes like so like in pop music, yeah. You know, and so if they continue along that path, and if you started hearing like the Autechre influence in other things, it would sort of like, I think, cheapen Autechre. It's the, you know, when something becomes cliche in a movie or something, and then you go back and you watch like the movie that invented it, it feels cliche and it like, you know, ruins and cheapens it. So I'm glad like Autechre, you know, don't fall into that. You know, I don't feel like it's on purpose on their part. They just feel, it just seems like from, you know, what I know about them, that they seem like people who just like have to move forward, you know, like,
yeah
it's just like in their DNA, you know, to have to do these kind of things.
It's just interesting, I think, because like after Radiohead, it's no longer weird for, you know, it's not like even worth noting on in the music press that like an artist is incorporating a rock artist is incorporating electronic, you know, elements and stuff like that. And so it's like, yeah, fitting that Autechre just kind of like went their own way and went far, far away from the mainstream at this point of like really oversaturation. I also wanted to highlight Drug Use, which Aphex Twin's Drug Use, which came out in 2001, the same year. You know, I mentioned it on the LP5 episode because I was sort of speculating, like, what if they were kind of, you know, there was like this arms race going on where it was like Autechre had joined the fray and was like, you know, we can up the Richard D. James album. You know, we can like take this to wider extremes, and drug use goes like absolutely crazier in that direction. And it just feels like Confield is like the end of the arms race for me. I wanted to describe this album as like post drill and bass, because if you think about like, think about like Sco's Poise, like what is that? But like a completely fucked up, you know, like the drill and bass snare sound that's all over like the Richard D. James album or something. It's like just completely distorted and destroyed. And I just feel like, you know, this is overstating things for sure, but you know how like My Bloody Valentine just like ended shoegaze with Loveless, because it was like, what can you do after this? I just feel like Confield just kind of like ends drill and bass and that kind of music. Like it sort of ends IDM. It's just like, well, I guess this isn't a movement anymore. Like people are just, we're just going on our own way, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely can see it. You know, I don't think Aphex could have done a Confield, you know?
All right. So we should wrap this up, but I want to kind of end by asking you, you know, how difficult is this album really? Is its reputation deserved? We got an email from listener Cameron who says, Confield might be the fulcrum of AE's career. It still has melody, however obscure. It still has rhythm, however fragmented. It still has structure, however distorted. From here, each AE release pushed further and further past these traditional boundaries. I mean, don't get me wrong, Confield can be a challenging listen, but it's rewarding, and especially compared to some later material, unlocks its secrets pretty readily with a few listens. So is it just wrong that people have this idea of Confield as like the Mount Everest of Autechre?
I mean, maybe it's not the Mount Everest, but, you know, maybe it's a, I don't know, what's a medium sized mountain? It's the Rocky Mountains of Autechre.
Okay.
I've never seen a mountain. You know, I think like what listener Cameron says here is pretty good. You know, it is, challenging, but it's rewarding like pretty readily. You know, like, it took just a couple listens before I feel like I got it. And of course, you know, I like I've talked about, I like odd music, and I like all that electroacoustic stuff and everything. So, you know, maybe I already kind of have a foot in the world or something. So maybe it's just easier for me. But I feel like it's not like the hardest thing possible. You know, I feel like later stuff will be, you know, more difficult in length and just sheer mass and you know,
yeah,
crazy things that happen in LSEC and NTS and everything. But I think a fulcrum is you know, kind of maybe a better description rather than a mountain or anything. You know, it's not insurmountable, but it is sort of like the point at which like Autechre hinges on, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm tempted to say that this is the most difficult that Autechre gets. Like, I don't, you know, we'll probably return to this point, but I don't think of any albums after this as like as challenging as this one. So I do agree that it's a bit of a climb, whatever mountain you want to call it, but it is there. You know, it's there to get to it. I mean, you might say, and we could kind of shift into like just our closing thoughts, you know, I might say that they swung a little too far, perhaps, like from LP5, in the sense of like melody will become very, very secondary to sound design, to the point where it's like there's lots of lovely melody to find here, but it's clearly not the point. And
yeah,
you know, there are long stretches of this record where you're just listening to sound, and you got to be into that, you know. And I know that not all Autechre fans are just into like the pure sound world. So I came to love this album over these 2 weeks. It did click for me. Like I love every track. I think it's like a wonderful journey that it takes you on. And I'm like really in awe at several of the sounds here. I'm in awe at the whole package and the way like it really does just feel like they totally synthesize their sound design into creating like these singular objects or something that you can like close your eyes and imagine, no matter how bizarre they are. But you know, I'm just going to agree that it's probably not for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's safe to say. I mean, I came to love it too. And, you know, I say this every time, but it's always like when you listen to just the one album or whatever for 2 weeks, I always get this feeling of, is this the best Autechre record? And I have to like really, you know, kind of fight it and stuff. And, I don't think it actually is the best or anything, but I definitely came to enjoy it, you know, much more than I had in the past. And like, I mean, really in a way that I like, I hate that I didn't, you know, listen to this record as much before. You know, I feel like I've, you know, missed out on a lot of stuff here.
Well, we ready to move on to Gantz Graf?
Yeah. Ottekker released Gantz Graf more than a year after Confield on August 5th, 2002. However, Sean claims that the EP was done before EP 7 was released, but it was too distinct, so we held it back. Then it occurred to us to get Alex Rutherford to do a video for it because he'd already sent us some test vids, so it got held back even longer. Indeed, Gantz Graf originally came packaged with a DVD featuring a new music video for the title track, the previous released video for Bass Cadet, and a re-edited version of the video for Second Bad Bible. Alex Rutherford's Gantz Graf video is about as famous as the track itself, but we'll get to that in a little bit.
Yeah, in regard to reception, the critics who loved or at least respected Confield were all a bit lukewarm on Gantz Graf. Allmusic gave it 3 stars, but called it, quote, nearly 20 minutes of prime audio beat mulch. I think that's a compliment. I honestly don't know. While Pitchfork gave it a 7.0 and wrote, these tracks are just cool downs from Confield or possibly warm ups for the next album. Fans, on the other hand, seem to love this EP. It's currently got a 3.55 average rating on Rate Your Music, which makes it Ottekker's third highest rated EP there after Garbage and EP7. We finally reached the end of the EP's box set, which we keep alluding to because we've listened through that box set many times, but I still got to ask, how new was Gantz Graf to you?
Kind of similar with Confield and, you know, I'm going to say this for the next couple episodes, but I've listened to every Ottekker release at least a handful of times in my life. This like Confield is one that I never really listened to on its own or spent like a ton of time with.
Yeah. I guess I'm the same. I've definitely listened to it, but it, you know, wasn't something that I ever sought out and wasn't something I really listened to outside of the context of the box set. So, how would you describe the overall sound of the Gantz Graf EP?
Frantic, maybe. You know, it's
yeah.
You know, if you think Confield has a bit of that, you know, Venetian snares, you know, break core kind of thing in it. You're in for a treat here on Gantz Graf because it really shines.
Yeah. I mean, it is like wildly aggressive out the gate. It is quite frantic. You know, like the second track, Dial, is, you know, it's got these kind of like notes that, you know, they're just playing so fast and they start to kind of like just go up and up. You know what I mean? Like doom, 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 doom. And like the whole thing is so frantic and wild. I mean, it is like really anxiety inducing, I think. Things settle down briefly on cap 4 or cap IV and then go crazy. You know, I jotted down, I thought I was listening to a Boards of Canada track, but I'm listening to a Merzbo track now and I don't know where that switch exactly happened. I mean, really aggressive and noisy. I just gotta like compliment, you know, this quality of, I mentioned on Confield how you can like shut your eyes and think of the shapes of the tracks. And we mentioned how they feel sort of organic and like living or something. Here, you can do the exact same thing, but I feel like the shapes I imagine are so, so different. Like they are much boxier, sharper edges. You know, when I listen to Dial, I think of like these, you know, like metallic boxes. Like this is no longer organic material like Alien or something. You know, Gantz Graf is like power electronics, you know, turned into, you know, just like slamming, you know, thuds of sounds, but it's just like large metal objects or something. You know what I mean? It's like, how does it compare to Confield as far as sound design goes?
Yeah, I think you're right on the money. It's got like a more like industrial feel, and I don't mean like industrial music. Mm-hmm. I mean industrial in like you said, like metal and inorganic structure. I mean it definitely it like has that same kind of thing. Yeah, you can close your eyes and imagine it again, but I think you're getting totally different things. You know, I don't think of, you know, atoms and black holes and stuff here. I think of machines, you know, and things like that.
Yeah. I just think it's like so fucking impressive, honestly, that like it sounds like a similar rig, like the same rig maybe even, you know, but it's just like you shut your eyes and it's like a wildly different visual experience for me. Got to read another one of these narrative interpretations from listener Anton. He says, Gantt's graph represents being a baby toddler where you don't understand anything and are bombarded with a lot of information. After you revisit those times and gave enough thought to it, it starts to make sense and you can find a pattern. Also, it's the shortest time. Now, how you see the world yourself, but not how the, how you see the world yourself, but how long it actually is. After that, dial. It represents fear in childhood up to your 20s when you're starting to be self-aware and starting your own life. A phase which made me feel anxious and nervous a lot because I really cared about what others think about me and I had to learn how to live like an adult. If you get even older, you start to see things more relaxed, represented by cap 4. Life might get easier and you might start to enjoy it. But as life goes, you start to notice how fast it goes by. Year after year passes and it doesn't stop accelerating. Life suddenly just stops. Maybe it's just my life and I'm telling you some bullshit. My life is between dial and cap 4 right now. I bring this up because it's fun. It's a great interpretation. But also, do you hear, you know, any of that we talked about with Confield, like something human, something emotional, some, you know, something other than just digital insanity when you listen to Gantt's graph?
I mean, personally, no, but I mean, reading that email and stuff, again, like we talked about a little bit ago, you know, it's really interesting to see how other people, you know, think and feel about this music because, you know, when he says that, I completely understand what he means and I really do agree with him. But I did not have any of those same thoughts myself, you know, before reading his email or anything. And in fact, like I don't think I thought or felt like anything or organic at all.
Yeah, I mean, I feel those things like disorientation and stuff like that. But you know, I wanted to highlight like Cap 4, right, where it basically does a similar trick to Lentic off of Confield, the last track there, where it starts off quite pretty. It really does feel like Boards of Canada territory, especially with like these little high lead notes. And at a certain point, the melody takes a very minor turn and I am like overcome with dread. I don't know if that's because I know where the track is heading or if I would have felt that way like the very first time I listened to it. You know, I just wasn't like that consciously recording my thoughts the first time I ever listened to this album. But I am filled with dread and then like my brain is destroyed by the ending. And so you can add a narrative onto it, which is great, but I do feel like the, you know, the core feelings kind of similar to how we were talking about like, you know, black holes or just deletion in general or something on Confield, these core feelings that are described here by Anton, I totally get it. I also want to hit you with an email from listener James who says, Gantt's graph was one of the most heavy punk, industrial, and metal albums in my CD collection that carried the ethos of DIY. We will do what the fuck we want and you can hold on tight or walk away. I remember this one carrying so much of an anti-authoritarian message during the George W. Bush Endless War of Terror era. It felt like real protest music in the sense it sounded unlike anything mainstream or conventional and pointed to a world where we can make our own rules. What do you think about that description and that kind of cultural context in 2002?
Oh, I definitely agree with the, you know, sort of like metal aspect of it. You know, while it doesn't use, you know, maybe the same sounds or anything, I think it has like a similar, you know, feel or, you know, whatever to like black metal and stuff, which is what I'm most familiar with. As for the cultural aspect of it, I don't know. I don't know if I if I can agree. You know, I mean, what year did this come out? 2002. You know, I think it's easy to, especially when things are instrumental and have a band that like really doesn't talk about anything. You know, like they don't. You know, we talked about it. Like anti is the only time they've like explicitly been political or anything. I feel like it's easy to sort of like ascribe your own feelings or thoughts. You know, like, I don't think he's wrong. You know, it's not like I could see why, you know, that era and, you know, the war on terror, which is, you know, truly endless and still going on.
Right.
You know, could feel like Gantt's graph. But I don't know that was like the artist's intention. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, if, you know, if Sean is telling the truth, which you never know, but that Gantt's was actually made back in 1999.
Sure.
I'm sort of skeptical about that, but then, you know, that would like sort of eliminate that intentionality. But it is interesting to note that this is like the first post 9/11 Autechre release, and the world suddenly felt like a much more chaotic and crazy place for everyone. So I could totally see how this could be very fitting, just like we talked on our last listener email episode about one listener who said that EP7 was very fitting for the like run up to Y2K when it was quite scary what technology would do to our lives. And it does feel like protest music. It does kind of feel like it does have that punk ethos to it, I think. You know, I sort of jotted down like on Gantt's graph, you know, you start off with this like digital destruction and it like comes grinding to a halt and then is like slower. And it like works just like, you know, how like metal will sometimes, I don't listen to a ton of metal, but it'll like slow down and it's heavier. It's like 10 times heavier now that it's slow. And Gantt's graph like just achieves that like absolute fucking menace. It's a monster of a track, but you know, we can't really talk about, you know, I guess I could quiz you anyway, but you know, talking about favorite tracks, there's not that many to choose from. But what do you think is the highest rated track?
Probably title track, Gantt's graph.
Yeah, okay. I gave it away. What? There's one that's considerably lower than the others. What do you think it is?
Probably Dial.
Yeah, wow. Good job. You get, you know, one out of three. Odds were pretty good, but you nailed it. But, you know, do you love the title track most? I mean, what's your favorite moment here?
Yeah, basically, I mean, my guesses right there were just my personal feelings. I mean, Gantt's graph, while it's maybe not a song I want to, you know, listen to all the time or anything, because, I mean, it is so, like, fucking wild. I think it's really, like, great. And I think Dial is sort of kind of a little bit of a throwaway. It kind of reminds me of like you know, Peel session level sort of thing. You know, it's like it's nothing bad. It's just you know, it's not the best. Yeah, I wouldn't put it on my greatest hits you know, record or anything.
Wow.
And while we're here, you know, Cap 4, I think is much better. I like it a lot more than Dial. But you know, I don't think it rises to Gantt's graph. You know, level.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in awe at Gantt's graph. I think that the first time you listen to it, you're going to just feel like it's just abrasive noises, like slamming you in the face. But it actually does have a structure, and there's a lot of there's a musical quality to it. There's like these little melodic stabs that are kind of cutting through the chaos in a rhythmic way, and it sort of like slows down. But that, you know, that melodic thing is kind of like drawn out in a slow motion way with it, and you can still follow. And then, you know, it sort of returns to like what I would describe as the main riff, if you will. In the end, it's, you know, it's like a tight little 4-minute, you know, track that really just, you know, works like a single almost. I think it's like really brilliant. You know, in contrast though, I think the other two tracks are like stunning, and I think this record flows in like a wonderful way. I'm just like so impressed by Dial, like I said, for the like weird boxiness of it. I don't know how you achieve that with just digital sound design, but it just sounds like sharp corners everywhere. And it's like so frantic, and it just kind of like, I think just brilliantly, you know, keeps the energy, but like tones down the noisiness and aggression of Gantt's graph. And then you're kind of like, you know, you finally reach a place of peace with Cap 4, and then it just accelerates into pure Gantt's graph territory. Honestly, like it's almost like what I think that one listener was looking for in Lentic, the sense of it starts pretty and ends like in just total destruction. But I think that makes for like a brilliant, brilliant flow here. I want to read an email from listener Astrictal. I hope I wrote that right. Wasn't any name I recognize. Sorry if I'm mispronouncing it. But he says, I think Gantt's graph unfairly overshadows the other two tracks. Yes, it's the title track and has a pretty cool music video and is one of Autechre's most prominent tracks in their catalog. But the other two are just as great in my opinion. Cap 4 especially, I really like the ending to this one. The way that melody turns all somber around halfway into the track and the beat just gets gradually more and more crazy when reaching the end. It always gets me excited whenever I listen to it. And listener Joe said, Dial sounds like walking into some nightclub on the Confield planet and realizing that the music they play there is just as shitty as the music they play in most Earth clubs. I don't know if that's how you're feeling. Cap 4 sounds like the closest Autechre has ever come to doing Boards of Canada. Despite the beats that sound like a modified version of the ones on Yeezland, the soothingly satanic vocal sample, warm synths, and life-affirming chord progression make this one feel like some kind of BOC remix. It goes on a bit long, but it's still pretty cool. So it sounds like Are you kind of in the camp of like, this is Gantz graph with two bonuses, or do you kind of agree with me and some of these listeners that it does flow as a piece?
Yeah, I think I'm a little bit in the former there. I like Cap 4. I really like that the way it ends and everything, and like, you know, just builds. It's feeding like itself, you know, it's feeding back in on itself and just kind of growing more and more massive. Like I really like that, but you know, the track itself, like as a whole, I don't think is like rises to the level of that section of the track. And I don't think it's like, I wouldn't say Dial is shitty like this listener.
Yeah.
But you know, I think it really just like that song like rose to the Peel Session sort of level with me. You know, worth listening to if you're a fan. But not essential in any means. But Gantz Graph, like the song, I think like is essential listening. You know, here. So I guess yeah, it's a little bit Gantz Graph with two bonuses. With Cap maybe, you know, not being a bonus. You know, I'm a little more pensive with it with saying it about Cap, I guess.
Wow. Well, this might be the first release that we like strongly disagree on.
Yeah, that's true.
I just think it flows like so awesomely, and I feel like, yeah, maybe Dial isn't as like wow as the other two tracks, but it's like this perfect transition, I think. We got to spend a few minutes talking about the Gantz Graph music video, of course. Listener Spencer wrote us a very long time ago to urge us to talk about this video, saying, "It misses some details, but captures the mental, quote, motion I envision when I listen to the song better than any music video I've ever seen." And listener James wrote, "The accompanying music video was truly revelatory and laid to waste a field of musicians who put half a heart into conveying visual components with their medium. Autechre seemed as if they truly cared about aesthetics and sound explorations." So what do you think of Alex Rutterford's video?
I mean, it's really cool. I mean, I think it's exactly like sort of the thing that we've been talking about, like that, you know, this song and, you know, Confield and everything like makes you think of. It's really like, I mean, it's just like done so well. I mean, especially, I think if you just describe it, like if somebody hasn't seen it, like definitely watch it. Because if you just describe it, you know, it's really just sort of like the shapes and stuff that are like moving and everything like to the beat, which, you know, sort of like when you say that, like seems like kind of just okay, you know, or yeah, or like it's been done before. But it like really like perfectly syncs up. And I forget where I read it, but I read somewhere that like a lot of it is like actually like hand, you know, it's not like it's some sort of equalizer type thing, you know, that's like matching the mute, like it's like it's mostly like done by hand and stuff.
Yeah, we should mention that you know, apparently it's not really generative at all. I read that like 90% of it was done just manually, like you're saying.
Yeah, which I think like that is like really awesome, you know, because I mean it really like, I think like you'll easily think it's generative, which I mean I think goes with the theme of what we've spent right, so much time with Confit, you know, like Autechre and everything. But I think it's a great video, you know. I mean, electronic artists and music videos aren't a thing that like you frequently, you know, have to catch or something, but I think you really should watch Gantz Graph.
But I think that extra effort shows like to do it manually, because what's so striking about it to me is that you have this kind of metallic looking shape, but it's not like anything you've seen before. You know, it looks like,
yeah, it doesn't look like something. Yeah.
I mean, it looks like a motor part, but like for a futuristic spaceship or something, you know, like just something totally alien. But what I love about it is that it is a, you know, it's a symmetrical shape for the most part. It changes and like warps into different shapes throughout, but it's always like kind of a symmetrical, like smooth metal shape, like the kind of thing I picture when I really listen to the music, not just on Gantz Graph, but on the whole album. But the beat, you know, is affecting the shape, and it's getting distorted in very like irregular ways. I think that's that hand done quality where it's like, you know, breaking into shattered, you know, just fractured shapes. You know what I mean? So it's like, it's perfect, I think, for this song, because you do kind of imagine like something symmetrical, something like totally synthetic. And then you imagine that it's getting destroyed in, you know, something like an organic way, like glass never shatters in you know, a predictable pattern. It's like completely random, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think that's a good way to put it, you know? Yeah. It's really, it's hard to like overstate, like, I think how good it is.
Yeah. And it provides, like I said earlier, like, you know, if the little Confield, promo video did this a little bit, even though I'm sure like not many people ever saw it, this video is like your instruction manual, I think, for how to listen to Gansgraf and Confield. Like, just shut your eyes and think of what shape and think of what the track is doing to that shape throughout. I mean, I think that's why it's so brilliant. You know, got to read, let's see, another email from listener Cameron, who said, it's still one of the better music videos I've ever seen, period. Not to mention how perfectly it fits that kind of track while not being a simple beat match graphics novelty. So kind of what you're saying, totally agree. Do you think, though, that the Gansgraf EP would be as celebrated without this iconic music video?
You know, maybe not. I think like that is why, you know, Gansgraf, the song is sort of like, you know, well known. I'm not really sure where the video got played or anything, but I mean, you know, I think like it gives it that sort of single quality, which makes it more renowned.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess we should start shifting into the end game here. I want to get your sort of closing thoughts on Gansgraf. Maybe you can start by telling me where it landed on your, on our running ranking here of everything we've talked about.
Yeah. I put it, where did I put it? Number 12, on the list out of, we got 18 so far.
Behind what?
Right in between, right above Lego Feet, and right behind Anvil Vapor.
Wow. Okay. So not your favorite then?
No. I mean, like I said, I put it basically a couple notches above Peel Session, and that's essentially like Gansgraf the song. You know, carried it that far. You know, it's not reached its way into essential listening, I think. I mean, you know, the song Gansgraf is, but, you know, the EP itself, I don't think it's, like, irked its way up that far yet.
And where did you put Confield?
Confield, I put at number 5, in between, right above EP7 and right below Amber.
Wow. Okay, so give me your top 10 then.
Okay, 10, In Vain, Sickly Sweet, Garbage, Incunabula, EP7, Confield, Amber, LP5, Chiastic Slide, and Tri-Repete at number 1.
Wow, so for me, I put Gansgraf all the way up at number 6, above LP5, because I just wanted to be honest with myself, and I thought, what would I rather listen to? And I would rather listen to Gansgraf, because I think it's, you know, all the things that the listeners were saying. It is like a trailblazing, you know, just, it works like a punk album in the sense that you can't have like an hour long punk album. You know, you gotta have like a short, you know, just blast of energy. And so it's just 20 minutes, but it uses that time so perfectly. I think it flows like wonderfully. And I think just every track is kind of awe inspiring in its sound design. And there really is a lot of musical stuff to latch onto, maybe even more so than Confield. But I put Confield at number 4, just behind Amber. You know, I thought, this was the thing I struggled with. I was like, should it be above Amber or should it be below Amber? But I was really, really, you know, just absolutely impressed with them. I think it's like one of their finest accomplishments. But my top 10 right now is EP7 at number 10, Incunabula, En Vain, LP5, Gansgraf, Sickly Sweet, my beloved Sickly Sweet, which we've gotten a lot of hate mail about, actually. I don't know why it's so divisive. Number 4, Confield, 3, Amber, 2, Chiastic Slide, and 1, Tri-Repete. So, any closing thoughts on this chapter in the Autechre journey?
No, I mean, we at least both put it right under Amber, you know? But we're really starting to deviate. It's interesting. But I think that's about all I've got for now.
Yeah, me too. Just very curious as we wade further into the you know, slightly unknown territory here.
Yeah, exactly. Well, what do you think about Confield and Gansgraf? We're going to do another one of those listener email shows next week. So send us your thoughts, gauntcastpod@gmail.com. Next proper episode in 2 weeks, where we'll be looking at Draft 730. We want your opinions, hot takes, any of it, gauntcastpod@gmail.com. If you like the show, help us out, subscribe, leave a 5-star review wherever you get your podcast. Look us up on YouTube, stay connected, Twitter, Instagram is @GauntCastPod. And we'll see you next time.
See ya.